From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Michael Sandel is a public intellectual with the public profile of a rock star. He's a professor of government at Harvard University, and millions of people have watched his videos or taken his online courses on justice. His scholarship on what a just society should be has influenced the influential. He's author of several best-selling books, including Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do?, and What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. And now, Michael Sandel is looking across America today and asking, through his political philosopher's lens, what are the deepest drivers pushing this nation apart? His answer? A belief in meritocracy. Michael Sandel's new book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. And he joins us now. Professor Sandel, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
All right. First of all, let's start off with, I'd just love to hear what inspired you to look at merit right now in America as a place that you thought was worthy of some interrogation.
I began by wondering about what was behind the populist backlash in 2016 that gave us Brexit in Britain and then the election of Donald Trump in the United States. And at the center of the grievances that Trump and other authoritarian populists appeal to seemed to be a sense among many working people that elites looked down on them, and that these resentments had been gathering unaddressed by the mainstream parties for quite some time. Resentments that had a lot to do with the rising inequality of recent decades, the fact that wages were stagnant for a great many working people. But it went far beyond that. And what made it so combustible, I think, was the sense of demoralization, even humiliation, by those who were left behind, not only by the economy, but also in many ways by the culture. The work they did was no longer respected, accorded the kind of social esteem that it once was. And so that was really the beginning of trying to think through what produced these toxic attitudes towards success and failure that seemed to be leaving so many people feeling humiliated and disrespected.
So throughout this hour, I'm going to ask you many of the questions, some of which are a little challenging, okay? Because your book challenged me. I'll be perfectly honest about that.
All right.
And
I'm ready.
So let's begin with the inspiration for the book itself, as you just described it, because one could argue that really what you're talking about are white grievances, because there are many millions of Americans who are people of color, who are of the working class, who didn't buy Donald Trump's argument at all. They cast their ballots for Hillary Clinton. So, I mean, I think right up front, we have to talk about how race is shot through this.
I think race is shot through this. And the racism and the xenophobia and the misogyny in Donald Trump's appeal are unmistakable. So I would not deny that for a minute. We see more and more evidence of it every day. It's the very ugly feature of his politics of resentment and grievance that is on most vivid display. So there's no question about that. But the question, just as you say, and working people of color, by and large, did not vote for Donald Trump. They voted for Hillary Clinton. So the thing, and they formed a part of the traditional Democratic constituency. The thing to be explained in trying to make sense of how Donald Trump could win white working class voters, many of whom had voted Democratic traditionally, that's the challenge. Because these are the voters who provide the margin of victory for Donald Trump in the United States and for Brexit in Britain, for Marine Le Pen in France, and for other authoritarian populists. So I'm trying to identify those who traditionally voted for center-left parties, but who have been disaffected by those parties. And I'm trying to understand how that happened, Meghna. Mm-hmm.
So then I'm going to come back to this issue of race here, because I can't believe I'm saying this to Michael Sandel of all people, but I'm not entirely sure I'm convinced by your argument. But I want you to lay out more of your argument, okay?
Yeah.
So when we're talking about the disaffection in humiliation, even as you write, that is caused by the existence or the belief in a meritocracy, how do you define what that meritocracy is?
Well, at its most elemental, meritocracy is a perfectly good and sensible and just thing, which means considering people for jobs and social roles on the basis of their qualifications. That by itself is a good thing, especially if the alternative is hiring or promoting people based on prejudice or animus or nepotism. So that's a good thing. And so you're pressing me to say, Meghna, then how can that perfectly just principle come to have a dark side? And it comes to have a dark side when you build a politics around two ideas. First, that what counts as merit is defined by the money people make, by the market. Mm-hmm. And second, when the mainstream parties, Democrats and Republicans, for four decades embrace a market-driven version of globalization that embodies this market faith, but adds to it the following response to the inequality that results. When inequalities deepened over the past four decades due to globalization, the Democratic Party in particular did not take on that inequality directly, but rather with the following message. The response to inequality is individual upward mobility through higher education. And we heard this from politicians, beginning actually with Ronald Reagan, that what America is all about is if everyone has an equal chance, people should be able to rise as far as their efforts and talents will take them. I call this the rhetoric of rising. Now, this may seem to be synonymous with the American dream itself, but it's interesting. I went back, Meghna, and looked at the presidential discourse historically. And this phrase, this rhetoric of rising, only comes in the 1980s with Reagan as a prominent feature of discourse. It's taken up by Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton. And the project that it identifies is, we'll deal with the growing inequality of globalization, not directly, not by restructuring the economy or rethinking the shape of essentially neoliberal globalization policies, but instead by saying, if you want to compete and win in the global economy, go to college. And then you too may be able to climb the ladder of success. The reason this message lost its capacity to inspire is partly because social mobility is stalled. It's actually harder to rise one generation to the next in America than it is in many European countries and in Canada. But there's a further problem, which is implicit in that promise is an insult. The insult is that if you didn't go to college and if you're not flourishing in the new economy, your failure is your fault. It's your responsibility. And I think that Democrats were not alive to this insult and the resentments that it generated, which essentially led a great many working people, and yes, you're right, disproportionately white working class people, to abandon the Democratic Party, which had been their natural home, and embrace Donald Trump.
Yeah. So, Professor Sandel, I'm in complete agreement with you about the incontrovertible, I would say incontrovertible fact that the freezing or even reduction of social mobility in this country is a poison. It's a poison in our democracy. The inequalities that have been produced by that are tearing apart the fabric of this country. Complete agreement. But in the description, in the argument you just laid out, you began with this concern about the center left or the elite of the center left being deaf to this. But the
right. But
the examples that you used were bipartisan examples. I mean, you named Republican and Democratic presidents here. So, I mean, I don't see this as particularly a failure of the center left or liberal elites. Is it not a failure of? We'll see how you define elites in just a second, but is it not just a failure of the elites of this country, period, full stop?
Yes, it is. Though after the full stop, I'd like to add this qualification, Magna, which is, if you look around the world, the parties that have been the greatest casualties of the populist backlash have been center-left parties. And it is worth asking why that's the case, because you're certainly right that elites generally have been the target of populist backlash. It's a bipartisan turning against elites. But center-left parties in particular have suffered in electoral terms. And this has been true not only here and in Britain, but also in France and in Germany and in other countries where center-left parties have been decimated by the populist backlash. And that's because these are the parties whose historic role it has been
to confront
inequality.
I'm so sorry to have to interrupt you. I want you to pick up that thought when we come back in just a quick second. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Michael Sandel. He's a professor of government at Harvard University, a best-selling author of several books, including Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do?, and What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. He's one of the nation's best-known public intellectuals on the issue of what makes a just society. And his latest book takes a look at the belief in meritocracy. It's called The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. And Professor Sandel, forgive me for having to interrupt you before the break there. If one of the tyrannies in my life is that of the clock, so we had to take that break. But you were saying why you thought that the center left in particular had been very vulnerable to the populist uprisings we've seen in various countries. And I wanted to allow you to complete that thought.
Thank you. It's an important question because elites generally have been the target of the populist backlash, but it's center-left parties that have lost most. That's partly because their traditional mission and role has been to confront inequality, to hold capitalism to democratic account. That's been the mission of center-left parties. And that's what they failed to do during the period of globalization during the last four decades. There's one other aspect of this that's related, which is during the last three decades or so, the center-left parties, and this is true of the Democratic Party in the United States, became parties more attuned to college-educated professional elites than to the blue-collar workers who were their traditional constituency. And this, I think, further alienated working class voters. And we see this in the United States, we see it in Britain, we see it in France, where if you look at non-college educated voters, traditionally, they voted the Democratic Party, for the Labour Party in Britain, for the Socialist Party in France. And Thomas Piketty, the economist, has shown that in all of these three countries, that partisan, the educational profile of voters of these center-left parties has flipped. So now it's the college educated, those who do not have a four-year college degree, voted for Donald Trump and for Brexit. And so this, I think, is another reason, or at least reflection of the center-left parties taking the biggest hits from the populist backlash. Mm.
There clearly seems to be some pattern there that is crying out for explanation. But I'm going to ask you to forgive me several times during this hour. Professor Sandel, in your description, though, that description, as I hear it, almost it negates once again the existence of all the people of, in the United States, the people of color who are in the working class as well, who don't have college educations. Because, I mean, as you point out in the book, I mean, most American adults do not. And so, right. I guess I'm still not fully understanding how your argument confronts the reality that not every member of the working class in the United States, by a long shot, when we look at of Americans of all colors, acted on the grievances here that you're describing, or blamed the inequality on the college educated elites of the center left.
Well, that's certainly true. But what we're trying, if our question is how to explain the success of Trump or of Brexit or of Marine Le Pen in France, then we need to ask why is it that they were able to win over white working class voters who traditionally voted for the center left? So it's by no means to negate the importance or the significance of working class people of color. Far from it. It's simply a matter of what question we're trying to answer. And if the question is, what accounts for the people who voted for the working class people who voted for Barack Obama even twice and then flipped over to Trump, we have to try to identify who those people are and then ask ourselves the question, why did they change? What accounts for that? So it's really a question of what are we trying to answer? What are we trying to address? And I would say, I think the Democratic Party is missing something important. That's one of my reasons for writing this book. The Democratic Party is focused rightly on the serial outrages of the Trump presidency, his constant inflaming of racial tension, his violation of constitutional norms, his botching of the pandemic, but focusing on these many ways he is unfit for office may not be sufficient to defeat him. And the reason it may not be sufficient is that it doesn't really Democrats, I think, need to look in the mirror and ask, what is it about their commitment to market-driven or neoliberal globalization policies, including the deregulation of the financial industry, handling the bailout after the financial crisis in a way that was pretty gentle on Wall Street and did very little to help ordinary people who had lost their homes? I think the Democratic Party needs to ask, what is the source of the sense of humiliation among white working class voters, not because they should ignore or turn their backs on people of color, far from it, but because politics is about persuasion. And to persuade, one has to try to diagnose what's gone wrong.
Right. No, point taken and agreed. But I keep thinking about how you're rightfully looking at Marine Le Pen, Nigel Farage, Donald Trump, right? And what's another thing that actually unites them in their populist successes? I mean, maybe we can't say Le Pen has been quote-unquote electorally successful yet, but I know what you're trying to say here. But the other thing that unites them is just naked xenophobia, right?
And so
how does that play in, if at all, to your argument about meritocracy?
Right. Well, the xenophobia is an important part of this. And what is with the xenophobia and with the racism and misogyny of these figures, and especially of Trump, I think it's important to disentangle the legitimate grievances that they are successfully able to appeal to from the ugly sentiments, the xenophobia, the racism, and the misogyny with which those grievances are entangled. This is a toxic brew of grievance, Meghna. Mm-hmm. But in politics, sometimes a toxic brew of grievance can contain strands, elements of legitimate grievance. And so this is the big challenge. Let me focus on the xenophobia for a moment. Xenophobia refers to the anti-immigrant hostility of these figures. Part of what enables them to make that appeal successfully is that after four decades of globalization embraced by the mainstream parties, there was a tendency for governing elites to begin to devalue or to ignore the importance of national identity and community and belonging. And I think Democrats can and should pay more attention to the question of what do we share and what do we owe one another as Americans, as citizens of this country, quite apart from, beyond the cosmopolitan aspirations we may have to strengthen global institutions and a global sense of human solidarity. So the xenophobia is dark and ugly and condemnable, but it has its political persuasive power, because meritocratic elites who have embraced neoliberal globalization essentially left an empty space where national identity, loyalty, community, patriotism could be. So even there, even with the xenophobia, I want to disentangle the possibly affirmative strands from the dark, ugly strands that we see with Trump and the xenophobic populace.
Indeed, and those concepts of national identity, the common good, patriotism, I would say the other major failing of center-left elites was allowing the right wing to define those things away from them, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. And I've been worrying about this since long before Trump, as you know. And I think Trump has managed to fill that moral and civic vacuum where patriotism and national community once resided. So I think Democrats neglect the significance of the social ties that hold our country together and the sources of pride that people take in national community, even as we seek to transform our country, given the deep injustices that are also a part of our national identity. But by embracing a kind of neoliberal or market-driven globalization project, governing elites, and especially Democrats, too readily embraced cosmopolitan identities to the neglect of a sense of national community. And I think this was a defect in the Democratic political message and governing vision.
You know, Professor Sandel, when you use the word disentangle, I think that's of fundamental importance here, especially when we're talking about how this belief and concept of meritocracy is woven into American culture, okay, or right. political culture. So I'd like to actually work at disentangling that a little bit more, because, I mean, broadly speaking, meritocracy, in a rough definition that I would offer, is that, you know, that belief that you rise, as you said, rise or fall by the dint of your own capacity and will, right? And that, in fact, that's even a superior way of viewing how we live as individuals and as communities. The funny thing is, though, is I see that exact same ideology at work on both on the right. Right. I mean, the conservative movement spent the better part of 40 years, I would say, essentially pandering to working people, telling them that they are smarter and more qualified to figure out how to save their money for retirement, how to figure out how to pay for their own health care, to shoulder the individual responsibilities that used to be core threads of the social safety net, because they could do it better than government, that they had more merit in making those decisions than government. That's sort of a funhouse mirror version of meritocracy that's also at work in this country.
Yes. And what you're putting your finger on here, Magna, is that this idea of freedom, that if chances are equal, the whole point of our moral and political project is to enable people to rise by dint of their own effort and talent. This idea is embraced by the right and the left, and has been, especially during these recent decades, with different interpretations about what that means. Conservatives want laissez-faire policies. They think that's the best way of freeing people to rise. Whereas those on the center left say, well, wait a minute, we have to provide certain basic prerequisites, a certain safety net, healthcare and childcare and sick leave and housing for everyone and education, and then the people will truly be free to rise based on their talent and efforts. We really have to bring everyone up to the same starting point in the race before we begin rewarding merit. So there are these differences about what a respect for this kind of freedom to rise requires. But you are right. Both center-right and center-left political parties are operating from this same fundamental vision. There's one other element, and I think both of them have missed something. I think they both have, because I think this idea that we are ultimately self-made and self-sufficient is flawed. That's the deeper claim here, because what it issues in is that those who succeed, according to this vision, not only have risen by dint of their own talent and effort, but they also come to believe that their success is their own doing, the measure of their merit. And by implication, that those who fall short have no one to blame but themselves, because they too were free to rise if the chances were equal. My claim is not only that chances are not truly equal, that we don't live up to the meritocratic principles we profess. My stronger claim, and maybe this, Magna, is where you would take issue with me, or at least be taken aback, is that even the ideal itself is flawed. Even a perfectly meritocratic society with truly equal opportunity even that would not be a just society. And we can discuss why it wouldn't be, if you like.
I definitely want to, because obviously your decades of scholarship on what makes a just society actually is what I think makes your analysis of merit the most potent. So let's do that when we come back. We're talking with Michael Sandel. His new book is The Tyranny of Merit: What's Become of the Common Good. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A little later in this week, we're going to be talking about unemployment. Of course, it's been half a year now since the pandemic triggered historic mass layoffs in this country. And we want to know if you're one of the folks who has not received unemployment benefits, or if you've had a really hard time, impossible time, navigating the system in order to get those benefits. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 with your story about unemployment. That's for a show that we're going to be doing later this week. This hour, we are speaking with Michael Sandel. He's a professor of government at Harvard University, author of many best-selling books, including What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets, and Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do. His scholarship on justice is known worldwide. His latest book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. And Professor Sandel, you absolutely did anticipate what my next question was going to be, because I have this sort of like endless Google Doc of notes in front of me I have for every show. And one of them was this. I was going to ask you, if you did away magically with America's really deeply ingrained love of meritocracy, if you leveled the playing field or had everyone starting from the same starting line, whatever analogy we want to use, some people are still going to run faster. The outcomes still won't be the same because people are different. Even within supposedly homogeneous groups, people still have different outcomes. So what then? How would we achieve a just society? Or what is a just society in that model?
Well, the first thing we would need to do would be to rethink our notion of who deserves what and why. We've been talking about the vision of freedom that makes meritocracy appealing, but closely connected to that is the idea of deservingness. If there really is a level playing field, or if there were, then those who landed on top would be able to say, my success is my own doing, and therefore I deserve the benefits that flow from it. Here's why that's flawed. Let's take a concrete example. LeBron James is a great basketball player. He's enormously gifted. He practices very hard to cultivate his talents, but he has enormous gifts. Is it really his doing that he has the athletic gifts that enable him to be as great as he is? More than this, is it really his doing that he lives in a society that loves basketball? If he had lived back in the Renaissance, they didn't much care about basketball then. They cared more about fresco painters. So what even a perfect meritocracy would lead us to overlook are the elements of luck and good fortune that enable us to flourish because we happen to live in a society that prizes the talents we happen to have. It also leads us a meritocracy, even a perfect meritocracy, invites us to forget this, not only the luck involved, but also the sense of indebtedness to family, to community, to country, to the conditions, the circumstances of life, the era in which we live, that are so much a part of success, even if we could imagine a level playing field. And when we forget these things, when we forget the luck and good fortune that helps us on our way, we find it hard to picture ourselves in other people's shoes. An appreciation of the role of luck in life can prompt a certain humility. There, but for the luck of the draw, or the accident of fate, or the grace of God, go I. That ability to see, to realize that it might have been otherwise for us, can lead us, I think, to look more generously upon fellow citizens less fortunate, less credentialed than we are.
But if I might say, I mean, this what you're saying presupposes that those, the jobs that those fellow citizens have, bus driver, coal miner, janitor, what have you, that those people don't want those jobs. I would say that folks find or would hope to find great dignity in the work that they do, that there are many people out there who choose to be bus drivers because that is the work they love. The problem isn't the lack of credential. I mean, we're talking about how a society values work. The problem is the income. The problem is the lack of economic security.
There are two problems, certainly that, income and economic security, and where the market is the measure, or seen to be the measure, of the value of one's contribution to the common good, then it becomes very difficult to reward work in accordance with its true contribution to the common good. We tend to devalue those roles. Income, pay, economic security is one very important part of it. But also important is esteem, recognition, respect, dignity. And during the age of merit, or I should say of market-defined merit that has unfolded over the last four decades, we have failed in both regards to accord dignity to work, both with regard to economic rewards and with regard to social recognition and esteem, which is why I think as an alternative to the project of individual, of the promise of individual upward mobility through higher education, we need also to focus on the dignity of work right at the center of our politics and ask how we can make life better for people, whether or not they have a college degree.
I'm in total agreement with you about the fundamental, I think, requirement of us all as Americans or people living in this country to treat each other with respect and dignity and accord that dignity to everyone's vocation. Absolutely. So how do we do that? I mean, you rightly pointed that basically market-driven economy is one of the measures of that is income, or maybe I pointed that out. But so what is the alternative way to confer or recognize or celebrate that dignity?
I would say a couple of things. First, and this will come as a challenge, maybe, and a provocation to you or to others, Magna, we should reconsider whether universities should be cast as the arbiters of opportunity, who define the merit that is the basis for social reward and recognition. Broadening access to higher education is a good thing. I mean, I would be the last person to say that it isn't. I've spent my career in higher education. But we've really cast the universities as great a kind of great sorting machine in a meritocratic age. And not only does that lead to excluding a great many people, but I think it's not so good for the universities themselves, who get diverted from their educational mission because the credentializing function and so on begins to crowd out the educational function. So I think we need to make massive investments in 2-year community colleges, in technical and vocational training, not only to provide necessary support to the settings in which most Americans actually learn what they need to know to flourish in the economy, but also as a way of enhancing the respect and esteem, of trying to scale back the hierarchy of prestige that exists in this country, less so in Europe, mm-hmm. by the way, between brand name 4-year universities and the other forms of learning that take place in community colleges and in technical and vocational training.
I'm not.
That's one.
I'm just to respond to your first prescription there. I am not challenged by that. I'm in agreement with that because, first of all, only because upon hearing your answer, I mean, higher education is a big, large thing, and I appreciate you focusing on saying that what we need to do is actually support certain parts of higher education that haven't actually traditionally received as much attention or support as others, such as the institution where you teach at Harvard. Yeah. But if in your book, though, you say, for example, at I guess the elite quote unquote elite colleges and universities in this country, that maybe they should have an admissions policy based on a lottery, with a little caveat that once a potential class of appropriate diversity and qualification is sorted, then apply the lottery to within that group of folks. Do I have that right?
Well, yes. This is not a solution to the lost dignity of work, but it is among the proposals I make to address another aspect of the dark side of meritocracy. And that's the tendency, that's what I've been calling the meritocratic hubris of the successful, the tendency of those who land on top in the economy, or those who win admission to highly selective colleges and universities, to believe that they did it, by themselves, that their success is their due, that they deserve it. Now, it's very hard not to think that if you're a young person who grows up where facing a kind of meritocratic gauntlet of stress-strewn achievement and to build a resume for college, to get good grades, to take SAT tutoring, all of that. The message drummed into you is that effort is all, and you had better expend effort to be competitive for these places. The ones who prevail, and I see this among many of my students, they arrive wounded by this meritocratic gauntlet. And very often, they become so accustomed to the pressure for achievement and the hoop jumping that they find it hard to step back and reflect on what's worth caring about and why learning about new fields of endeavor, because the habit of being driven is hard to shake. So to break down this sense of hubris, I propose this lottery among the qualified, which can be designed to accommodate diversity, mainly as a way of sending the message that there's a lot of luck that goes into this. And that's true whether or not we use the lottery. That's the message.
You know, Professor Sandel, I wish we had many hours to talk because I would come back to the lottery amongst the qualified and ask you about the qualified part. We only have 3.5 minutes left here, and there's two last things I wanted to touch upon of the many, many, many thoughts that you put in this book. But one of them was, we talked about higher ed, but you had another sort of part of your prescription on conferring dignity to all Americans that you thought was very important. And I wanted to give you a chance to tell us the other part.
Well, thank you. And that has to do with the dignity of work itself, which I say should be put at the center of our politics. And that's a big project because it involves challenging the idea, which is deeply held, that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the common good. I think that's a mistaken idea. And I think we need to devise policies not only to increase the rewards of those who perform what we now call essential work. In the pandemic, we see how dependent we are on the work of workers who are often not well paid or highly honored. And I think we need to, I'll give a few quick examples. We should consider, for example, wage subsidies combined with an adequate minimum wage so the companies can't claim a big part of the wage subsidy. We should debate that. We should strengthen trade unions to give workers more of a voice, not only in companies, but also in the wider society. And I think we should consider the outsized rewards enjoyed by those in the financial industry who, to put it gently, do not necessarily contribute in an outsized fashion to the common good. I'm thinking of those involved in highly speculative parts of finance or high-speed trading. They reap enormous rewards, arguably out of all proportion to the true value of their contribution. So here's one proposal just to prompt that public debate, Meghna.
Yeah.
I propose reducing or eliminating the payroll tax, which is a tax on workers, and to make up the funds through, or at least in part, through a financial transactions tax, especially targeted to speculative trading and derivatives, the kind of finance that doesn't really help the real economy, and not only for the distributive effect of that, shifting the burden from modestly paid workers to lavishly paid workers, but to prompt a debate about what really constitutes a contribution to the common good. And maybe the market doesn't give us a very good answer to that. There are other proposals, but the general idea is to have a real public debate about what counts as a contribution to the common good, and can we get over the habit of a market-driven age that outsources our moral judgments to markets?
Well, Michael Sandel's latest book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And if you're in the Boston area, he will be speaking about it tonight. Again, more information at onpointradio.org. Professor Sandel, consider this the first of many hours that I hope to talk with you about this over in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you, Magna.
This is On Point.